When he was a few feet away from me, the trail above us collapsed, just peeled away from the mountain. The tree that Jamie had tied the rope to came down, too. Jamie fell. He slid right past me, over a cliff, onto the trail below, and hit his head on a rock. That was how it happened, at 2:18 on the day after our 10th anniversary. It was 2 days before I noticed that the hands of my watch were frozen. I must have hit it on something when I fell. I've taken it to 3 different jewelers, and none of them were able to fix it. When Jamie gave it to me, I told him I'd never take it off, and I never have. I never will. I don't ever want to forget him. Luke was quiet, looking at me, probably wondering why I wasn't crying. I was wondering myself, but instead of asking about that, Luke said, "Is that what you're afraid of? That you'll forget him?" His question took me by surprise. "I'm not afraid," I said, my voice sounding a little defensive even to my own ears. "I could never..." Before I could finish the sentence, the door of the coffee shop opened and Ava stepped inside, her eyes searching. "There you are," she said, crossing the room to our table. "Denise said I could probably find you down here." "Coffee break," I said, feeling like I'd been caught doing something wrong. "I thought the off-site meeting was going to last all day. Is everybody back?" I asked, though I was really only concerned about Gavin.
"Just me. When you're done, could you come up to my office? I need to..."
For the first time, she glanced at my coffee companion and pulled up short.
"Luke,"
she said, sounding as surprised as she looked.
"I didn't realize that you two..."
"Ava, nice to see you." Luke started to get to his feet, but Ava waved him off.
"No, no, I didn't mean to interrupt."
She looked at me.
"As soon as you're done."
"I'll be right up," I said, and reached for my purse.
"No, it's fine," she said, sounding more flustered than I'd ever heard her. "Take your time. I'll be in my office. Nice to see you, Luke."
She left quickly. "I should go." I reached into my wallet, took out a $20 bill, and handed it to Luke.
"Grace, I was just teasing before. You don't need to pay me back."
"I insist."
"I don't have any change," he said, folding the bill and putting it into his shirt pocket. "Guess that means that next time I'll buy the coffee."
I told him to keep the change, but what I really meant was I didn't plan on seeing him again. Luke was a nice man. There was no doubt about it. But nothing had changed. Jamie was gone, but he had my heart. Luke got the message. When I got up from my chair, he did the same and reached out to shake my hand.
"I'm glad you're okay, Grace. Good luck to you."
"Thanks for the flowers," I said, picking them up from the table. "Say, I forgot to ask. How do you know Ava? Are you friends?"
"Not friends," Luke said, shaking his head. "But we were married for 5 years."
To say that was one of the more awkward exits in my life would be an understatement. Luke had been married to Ava? I didn't know either of them all that well, but they just didn't seem like they went together. But obviously, since the marriage had only lasted 5 years, they didn't. I said goodbye, thanked him again for everything, and left. When I got to the office, Ava was waiting for me. She got right to the point.
"Grace, I hope you know how sorry I am about your loss, but we're going to have to make a change."
"A change?" I asked, not entirely sure I understood. "Do you mean that you're..."
"Letting you go, yes."
My jaw went slack. "You can't be serious. Ava, if this is about Luke, there's nothing going on between us. I barely know him."
Ava rolled her eyes. "Grace, the amount of time that's passed since I've seen or thought about Luke is longer than our marriage. I was surprised to see the two of you together, but that's not why I'm firing you. I'm just the messenger. Gavin's the one who wants you gone."
She heaved a sigh. "I tried to tell you, Grace. The only way you could keep this job was to make yourself indispensable."
"But I did. I worked 60 and 70 hour weeks. I came in on weekends. I took his car to the shop. I picked up his dry cleaning, for heaven's sake. I made the slides for his stupid presentation at the sales conference. I stayed up all night teaching myself PowerPoint."
"And then you disappeared for 2 weeks."
"My husband. was dying. What did you expect me to do?
Nothing, she said, her expression softer than I'd ever seen it. You did exactly what you should have done, went exactly where you were needed. Because you were indispensable, Grace. To Jamie. That's how it should have been.
But, Ava, I need this job. Let me talk to Gavin.
She cut me off with a shake of her head. I already tried. It's no use. I did get you 2 months of severance, but that's the best I could do. Gavin wants you to clean out your desk today. Your replacement starts tomorrow.
Today? They wanted me gone that day?
The confusion and anxiety I was feeling must have shown, because Ava got up from her chair and walked to the front of her desk, then sat down on the desktop and touched me on the shoulder.
Listen to me, Grace. You don't need this job, not anymore. You never liked working here. Now you don't have to.
The timing seems pretty awful, I know, but maybe it's for the best. You need to give yourself some time. Think of this as a chance to assess your strengths and weaknesses and figure out what you really want to do with your life. You were there when your husband needed you most. Nobody could have been more loyal. And I admire you for that, Grace. I really do.
Ava pushed herself off the desktop and into a standing position and put out her hand. The meeting was over.
Good luck to you, Grace.
Chapter 21. Grace. The pouring rain had softened to a steady drizzle. Walking toward the front door of my building, I spotted an enormous yellow sunflower sitting on the front steps. As I got closer, I realized that it was only a picture of a sunflower printed on an umbrella. Monica was underneath it, shivering, her feet wet, holding a foil-covered pan in her lap.
What are you doing here?
Waiting for you. I brought you some cannoli. I've been experimenting with some new recipes.
And you couldn't wait until Monday to share? What's the matter with you? You're getting soaked. Come inside.
I unlocked the door, set about turning the lights on and the heat up, then greeted Maisie, who wriggled in rapture over my return.
Oh, yes, I know, I cooed, squatting down to Chihuahua level. I'm glad to see you too. How about a biscuit before dinner?
Maisie let out an approving yip. I picked her up and started toward the kitchen, but stopped short when I realized Monica was still standing by the front door.
Aren't you going to come in?
Maybe not. I'm worried about getting water all over your wood floors.
Oh, Monica, hang on a sec.
After making a quick side trip to the kitchen for Maisie's biscuit, I grabbed an armful of towels from the bathroom, exchanging them for the pan of cannoli. While Monica dried off, I went into the kitchen, filled Maisie's bowl with kibble, and started making tea.
Shouldn't you be at the restaurant?
I called across the counter that separated the kitchen from the living room. Soon. Ben can handle things by himself for a bit. Monica walked into the kitchen in her stockinged feet. The bottom few inches of her pants were damp, but she wasn't dripping anymore.
You got caught in the rain, too?
She asked. I reached a hand up to my hair. After my unexpected ouster from Spectre, I'd gone for a long drive, taking my anger and anxiety out on the twists and turns of Portland's West Hills. Without the benefit of a blow dryer and styling products, my hair had dried into an unruly, frizzy mess.
I forgot my umbrella when I left the office, I said, lifting the foil off the cannoli.
There are a couple missing from the pan, Monica said as she pulled up the counter stool that was my only kitchen seating. A homeless woman came by asking for money. I didn't have any cash, so I gave her some cannoli.
Dishwater blonde hair and rhinestone nose piercing?
Uh-huh. The microwave beeped. I pulled out the mugs and tossed a teabag into each.
Must have been sunny. Did she look okay? I've been worried about her.
She looked pale and skinny.
That's normal, I said, and pulled two mismatched dessert plates out of the cupboard, then placed two pastries on each one. Sad, but normal.
She was starving, Monica said. I gave her a cannoli and she wolfed it down while she was standing there, so I gave her two more. I thought she might be high.
Probably.
Hey, Monica said, frowning as she looked around the apartment. When are you going to finish unpacking the boxes and actually move into this place? It really does look like a refugee camp. I mean,
Do you think you could invest in more than one stool, or maybe even a table? Possibly some plates that match?
I'm not too certain about the investment part, but as of today, I'll have plenty of time to unpack boxes.
I dug two forks out of a drawer and handed one, plus the mug of tea, to Monica.
They fired me.
You're kidding, she said, sounding surprised, but not quite as surprised as I'd have supposed.
Oh, Grace, that sucks. If there ever was a time that you needed a high-fat dessert, now is that time.
How true. Standing at the counter, I picked up my fork, took a bite of cannoli, and groaned.
Oh, Monica. Oh, wow, this is amazing.
She beamed.
Pretty good, right? I've been tinkering with the recipe.
Good. It borders on a religious experience. What's in here?
Besides the ricotta and sugar, marsala, slivered almonds, and a lot of lemon peel. Try the chocolate one, she urged. That's got hazelnuts and candied orange. She didn't have to ask twice.
Oh, wow, I said, closing my eyes in rapture. This one is even better than the other. How is that possible? And how did you know I needed this today?
How did she know? Okay, sure, I was just back from the funeral, but why would she be sitting on my front stoop in the rain at 5:30 when she knows I'm lucky to get home by 8?
I just had a feeling, she said quickly when I asked her, shrugging and looking very guilty.
You just had a feeling?
Come on, what aren't you telling me?
Her eyes darted away from mine and she licked her lips.
Monica, I said in a warning tone.
Okay, fine, I didn't have a feeling. Luke called me. He told me all about bringing you flowers and having coffee with you, and then how his ex-wife showed up.
And?
And after you left, it started to rain, so he stuck around and finished his coffee, waiting for it to let up. But it didn't, so finally he ran out to his truck. That's when he saw you, crossing the street without a coat, getting wet and carrying a box, and looking really ticked off.
He was watching me? I gasped.
Oh, stop it. You act like he's some kind of stalker.
Okay, sure, Monica said, spreading her hands a bit. He showed up in your coffee shop unexpectedly a couple of times. But that part was my fault.
Really, Grace, he wasn't watching you. He happened to see you, put two and two together, then called me. That's it. He wasn't stalking you. He was worried about you. Luke is a really great guy, trust me.
I heaved a sigh.
Fine, if you say so. I've bigger things to worry about right now. Anyway, I said, taking another bite of cannoli. I'm glad you're here.
Monica tisked her tongue. So, Gavin honestly fired you the day after you got back from your husband's funeral? That's one for the Heartless Hall of Fame.
Technically, I said, Ava was the one who fired me, but she was following Gavin's orders.
Wow. He didn't even have the guts to pull the trigger himself?
I shook my head. Nope. I'm sure he didn't consider it the highest and best use of his time. As you know, Gavin is very big on delegating the details to people lower in the pecking order.
What a sniveling little coward, Monica snarled.
For some reason, seeing the disgusted look on her face, like she was about to scrape something unspeakable off her shoe, felt oddly vindicating. I told her about my whole day, from the moment I stepped off the elevator that morning to the moment I stepped back on it, carrying the contents of my desk in a cardboard box. The worst part was that there was a security guard standing there, watching me while I cleaned out my desk. Apparently it's standard procedure now that Spectre bought the company, but it was so humiliating. What did they think I was going to do? I asked, crunching through the cannoli crust. Steal company secrets? Make a scene?
Well, I would have, Monica said. But you're not the scene-making type. How about a strongly worded letter to HR instead? Or better yet, Gavin's boss, something starting with, Dear Heartless Soulless Corporate Flunkies.
Monica hopped off the stool and helped herself to another pastry.
I actually was thinking about that, I said. They just brought on a new CEO, a woman. I thought I'd try writing to her. I doubt it'll make any difference, but they might add it to his file. And if nothing else, it'd make me feel better.
Good for you, Grace. I think you should.
One more, she asked, lifting a chocolate cannoli from the pan.
No, thanks.
I hadn't finished even half of the first two, not because I was concerned about the calorie count. Today, of all days, I was entitled to eat whatever I wanted, but because the turn of the conversation had killed my appetite. I put down my fork and looked at my condo for the first time in a long time, really looked at it, seeing it the way Monica had. Like everything else in my life, it seemed confused and disjointed, a great big mess. You know, my mom was trying to convince me to move back to Minnesota, but I told her I couldn't because of my job. Now I don't have a job. And look at this place. I've never really lived here, just occupied the space. I'm practically a squatter, I said morosely. What in the world am I doing here?
Well, being my friend, for one thing, Monica replied, turning her back to the counter and crossing her arms. That might not be all that important to you, but it's very important to me. And to Nan. But hey, if you want to run back to Minnesota with your tail between your legs, move into your mother's basement and milk cows for the rest of your life, I guess that's your business. But if you think I'm going to let you skip town before the dog mother's ball, think again. I can't throw a party for 125 people and hounds by myself. I'm going to need a little help.
For your information, I said, I have never milked a cow. And I didn't mean it like that. I'm just... I blinked a few times. It's been a bad day, Monica. A really, really bad day.
I know, Monica said gently, crossing the tiny kitchen to stand next to me. A bad day after a bad week and a bad month and a bad 2 years. I get it, I do. You're entitled to spend some time feeling sorry for yourself.
Thanks, I mumbled.
You're welcome. Monica put her arm over my shoulder and stood with me in silent solidarity. For about 10 seconds. Okay, she said, removing her arm. Time's up. I shot her a look.
I'm not kidding, Grace. It's true. You have all kinds of very good, very real reasons to sit here and feel sorry for yourself. I'm not trying to minimize what you've been through. But it's been like that for close to 2 years now. It's enough.
I tried to speak, to remind her about what Nan said, that there's no timetable for grief, but she wasn't having any of it.
Maybe there isn't, she said. But maybe there should be. Do you remember the night we met at the community center? All those weeping widows who'd been coming to the group for years and years without graduating? I wouldn't want to see that happen to you.
Okay, sure, she said, countering my argument before I even had a chance to speak. You could say it hasn't been that long, but if you really think about it, you've been in this exact same spot, grieving, for almost 2 years. Jamie's fall left him stuck halfway between one world and the next. You've been stuck too. But now, finally, Jamie is at peace. He's moved on. I know it's sad and hard, but nobody knows better than you that life is short, precarious, and precious. It's time for you to figure out what you want to do with yours. Find the thing that makes you excited to get out of bed in the morning.
Everybody keeps saying that.
Well, maybe everybody's right. And I hate to pull rank, but if Jamie were here, I bet he'd say the same thing.
I didn't like to say so, but she was probably right.
Did I ever tell you how I got to be a chef? Monica asked. I was working at this restaurant, waiting tables. The food wasn't very good, and, you know, shrinking violet that I am, she grinned, I kept giving the chef suggestions, just by way of being helpful. One day, I told him his marinara sauce needed more garlic. He started screaming, said I was fired, and that he didn't need some stupid, scrawny, mouthy girl telling him how to run his kitchen, and that if I thought I knew so much about cooking, then maybe I ought to open my own damned restaurant. Then he threw a colander at my head. And as I ducked, I thought, you know something? Maybe he's right. 6 weeks later, I was enrolled as a student at Oregon Culinary Institute, and the rest is history. I've loved my work ever since.
Ever since? 2 months ago, you said you didn't like cooking anymore, that it was just a job.
Monica waved her hand dismissively.
That was just because I was frustrated with the kids.
Once Alex quit spending every waking moment figuring out how to make my life miserable, I started loving my job all over again. Especially when he was at the restaurant with me.
That was really fun. I mean, Zoe still keeps me awake at night, but I was actually starting to feel like I had the stepmother gig down. But, she sighed, since Alex recently decided he hates my guts again and has gone back to being a card-carrying jerk, I'm sure that's about to change. We've reverted back to our old roles. Once again, he is my rotten stepson, and I am the evil stepmother, Cruella de Vil in Chef's Whites.
Why? What happened?
She swiped a finger across her plate, capturing some leftover cannoli filling.
Oh, it's that girl, Gwen. She dumped him. He's heartbroken and miserable. And since misery loves company, she shrugged.
He'll be fine, but I kind of miss having him around the kitchen. She licked the filling off her finger. Speaking of the kitchen, I've got to get back to work. I walked her to the door. She put on her jacket and gave me a hug. Are you going to be all right? I nodded.
Thanks for the cannoli. It was just what I needed today.
And the advice? She asked, smiling wryly. Listen, I know I'm being pushy, but I really think a push is what you need right now. That being said, she paused abruptly and took a big, somewhat dramatic breath. I owe you an apology. That stunt I pulled, trying to throw you and Luke together, wasn't just pushy, it was stupid, and misguided, and really, really thoughtless. I tried to interrupt, to say that I knew her heart, if not her head, had been in the right place, but Monica shook me off. No, Grace, I was wrong, and I'm sorry. Watching the way you cared for Jamie in the last days of his life, never leaving his side for a moment, helped me finally realize just how wrong. You tried to make me understand how sacred your love and your marriage vows were to you. But I just didn't get it. Or, she said, her voice lower, her tone sincerely remorseful, maybe I didn't want to get it. The love you shared with Jamie, pure and totally unselfish. I've never known that kind of love. I probably never will.
Oh, Monica, don't say that. You'll fall in love someday. You will, I insisted, responding to the doubtful look on her face. Probably when you least expect it.
Yeah, sure. Maybe, she said, then grabbed her umbrella, which she'd left leaning against the wall to dry. But we'll worry about me another day. Right now my concern is you. I know this is the very last thing you want to hear, but Ava could be right, you know. Getting fired might turn out to be the best thing that could happen to you right now. Okay, sure. It would have been nice if they waited a week or two to can you, but it is what it is. The good news is you're still getting paid. The clock is ticking, Grace, but you've got 2 months to figure this out. So, for the rest of the week, you get to take it easy. Sleep till noon, play with your dog, eat stuff you shouldn't, and watch a really, really sad DVD. Something that will make you want to cry, yell, shake your fist at the universe, and get it all out of your system. Then get back to work and decide what you want to do with your life.
Easy to say, but how? Where do you expect me to start?
Monica pointed the tip of her umbrella toward a corner near the front window. How about that box? Chapter 22. Grace. When Monica left, I sat down on the floor and opened the box. It was filled with books. Maisie trotted over and lay down next to me, resting her tiny head on her even tinier paws, her big brown eyes shifting from the box to my face and back again as I pulled out book after book, used my sleeve to dust off the covers and read the titles, one by one. Little Women, The Devil Wore Prada, Jemima Jay, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, The Hardy Boys, The Haunted Fort, The Hardy Boys, The Vanishing Thieves, Little House in the Big Woods, Little House on the Prairie, Dune.
Oh, Jamie, I murmured, smiling to myself as I leafed through the pages, spotting passages underlined, sometimes twice, some with stars and exclamation points.
A tear came to my eye. I wiped it away, thinking about the day we'd packed that box. I could see why my mother thought we were going off half-cocked, moving halfway across the country to a city we'd never even visited,
putting a bid on a condo we'd never actually seen, but she didn't understand how much you could do on the internet, and we really did have a plan. We'd arranged for 3 months temporary housing and storage of our stuff until we could close on the condo. As soon as we arrived in Portland, I would get a job, and Jamie would go to school full-time, finishing his paramedic training in a year. Then it would be my turn. For what? I honestly didn't know. I wanted to start a family. We both did. But beyond that, I had no clue. But even though the condo was smaller than our garage apartment, after all those years of scrimping and saving, I was thrilled about finally having a home of our own. Our furniture was mostly borrowed or made of particle board, so we left it behind. Even so, we needed to weed out some possessions. Since both of us had pack rat tendencies, it wasn't easy, especially when it came to books. When we got to the sixth box, Jamie gave me a look and said, "Come on, Grace, do you really need the entire Little House on the Prairie series? Grammy gave me those for my 9th birthday." "Okay, fine, but do you still read them?" "Do you still read the Hardy Boys?" I asked, picking up a tattered copy of The Haunted Fort. "Hey, those are my dad's books. I can't throw them away." "Besides," he said, grabbing the book before I could toss it into the giveaway pile, "this book has everything. A stolen art collection, death threats, and ghosts. The Hardy Boys are going to Portland. All of them."
"Then so are Laura and the rest of the Ingalls family." Jamie picked another book out of the box.
"What about this? You've read it so many times you must have the story memorized by now."
"No way. Jo March is the sister I never had." I held up another volume.
"What about this one?"
Jamie's eyes bugged out of his head.
"Are you crazy? Dune is like the greatest book of all time, a classic. Dune insists that magic and fact are knit together in everything. It urges us to examine the miraculous alongside the mundane and see they are all of a piece. Plus, it has sandworms."
"Okay, fine, so we'll bring that one, too. And all the Harry Potters," I said. "We both love those." In the end, we packed them all. To make up for the wait, I left behind a lot of the dishes. They were mostly mismatches anyway, things I'd picked up cheap at yard sales. It was a good thing I'd never been much of a cook. That entire box was packed with books that Jamie and I had read and loved, familiar titles we just couldn't leave behind. However, at the very bottom of the box was a pristine, unread volume given to me by my cousin Melody not long before we moved, Me Before You, by JoJo Moyes. I set it on top of the stack of books before flattening the box for recycling. Later that night, I picked it up and brought it to my bed, a mattress and a box spring on the floor, planning to read just a few pages before falling asleep. At 2:38, after Maisie opened one eye and let out an irritated snuffle to let me know I was disturbing her beauty sleep, I finally turned out the lights. The next day, I woke up at noon, pulled on some yoga pants, and took Maisie for a walk. I didn't even bother to brush my hair, still frizzed and frightening from my trek through the rain. Returning home, I climbed back into bed with my dog, a bowl of peanut butter Cap'n Crunch, and the book. That was pretty much the agenda for the next 2 days. I hid under the covers with Maisie snuggled up beside me, ate stuff that was salty, sugary, crunchy, creamy, and devoid of all nutritional value, and read the heart-wrenching tale of Louisa Clark and Will Traynor. Upon closing the cover, I sobbed and shook my fist at the universe, cursing its cruelty to star-crossed lovers whose love is cut short. But mostly, I cried. For another 3 days, between trips to the bathroom and walks for the dog, I lay in my bed, a tangle of sheets and blankets sanded with crumbs from carelessly consumed snacks, and in a way I had never allowed myself to do in those whole 2 years since Jamie's fall, I mourned, finally letting the truth of Jamie's death sink into my soul. When I woke on the third day, I had no more tears, but a strange sense of being grounded, reattached to the earth and my life upon it. But what did that life look like if Jamie wasn't in it? What was I going to do now? I had no idea. But I decided to begin by taking Maisie for a walk.
Come June, Washington Park would be a riot of roses. That was one of the first sights Jamie and I saw upon moving to Portland, because everyone said you should, and they were right. Mid-April was too soon for flowers, but the subtle rise of temperature and lengthening of days had roused the rose bushes from sleep. The branches were as high as my waist and lush with leaves. While Maisie snuffled the grass and pranced along the edge of the flower beds, yipping at lackadaisical, utterly unimpressed squirrels, I leaned close and studied the green rosebuds, closed but plump, edged with delicate, almost imperceptibly thin ribbons of red, yellow, pink, and white, a whispered clue, a promise of summer and longer, warmer, better days to come. All that snuffling, prancing, and yipping wore Maisie out, so I picked her up and carried her home, down 23rd Street with the trendy boutiques and shops I still couldn't afford to enter, especially when I considered the limits of a 2-month severance and how far I could stretch it. To avoid temptation, I altered my route and took a street that was new to me. The church that I passed, a turn-of-the-century cut stone structure with heavy oak doors and a squat, square bell tower, housed a thrift shop, open 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. on weekdays. The shop was dusty and the aisles were narrow. The shelves were disorganized and filled with bric-a-brac, musty books, and painted portraits of other people's relatives. Far in the back, shoved up against a wall and partially hidden under a faded flower sheet, I spied a glimpse of blue. Pulling the sheet aside, I discovered a love seat with rolled arms and weirdly oversized ball feet. The lines were pleasing, but the light was dim, so it was hard to judge the exact color or condition of the upholstery. "Excuse me," I called to the white-haired woman who had cooed over Maisie's sweet little face a few minutes before, saying it was fine to bring her inside. "Are there any more lights back here? I'd like to get a better look at this love seat." "Well, let me see," she said, making her way toward me, navigating a labyrinth of old upright vacuums, dressers with missing handles, and children's toys. "I only just started volunteering, so I'm not sure where everything... Oh, wait, here's a switch." The room flooded with fluorescent light, harsh but bright. I thumped my palm against the armrest. The love seat coughed up a cloud of dust. It was dirty, no question, and those ball feet were absurd. But the velvet upholstery was untouched by moths and was a surprisingly beautiful sapphire blue. "How much is it?" I asked. "Well, let me see," she said again, craning her neck up, down, and sideways, searching for a price tag, finding none. "My goodness, I really don't know. But I think they'd be glad to let it go. It takes up so much space. Let me think." She did for a full minute, then cautiously asked, "Would $50 be too much?" In the end, I paid $122.50. But for that price, I got the love seat, a chair with a cushion and a curved wicker back, a generic floor lamp, a bed frame with a fake brass headboard, some battered floating shelves, a small pine desk, and an 8-place setting box of dinnerware that was missing only 2 salad plates. The dishes were so cute and cheery, raspberry pink with turquoise circles and a band of white dots along the edge. The woman agreed to hold everything for a few days, so I'd have time to unpack more boxes, and called the church secretary, who called the youth group leader, who arranged for a pickup truck to deliver everything I'd bought. It started so simply, with a half-hidden glimpse of velvet, blue, bright, and brilliant, that roused my craving for color and need to nest, hungers long silenced by the urgency of caregiving and the single-minded focus on simple survival. When I got back to the condo, I tore into the boxes, sorting and stacking the contents, figuring out what to toss, what to keep, and where it all should go. Some choices were easy. Opening the door to my closet, I spread my arms as wide as I could, corralled every item in my black, gray, charcoal brown, navy work wardrobe, and stuffed them all in the trunk of my car, along with every pair of toe-pinching pumps, before depositing them at the drive-through donation center of the nearest Goodwill store. When I opened a big plastic bin with yard after yard after yard of bright cotton dress goods, fabrics I had bought on sale and stowed away, and then found the box containing my sewing machine,
notions, scissors, and thread, I immediately carted them over to the keep corner with the rest of the stuff I couldn't live without. Other decisions were harder to make. No matter how much I loved them, there simply wasn't room for all those books. I weeded out a few of my own and quite a few of Jamie's, holding on to his Hardy Boys collection and, of course, his copy of Dune, before donating most of them to the downtown library for their annual used book sale. But I slipped one of each of our favorites, including much-read but well-preserved copies of Pride and Prejudice and The Great Santini, onto the shelf of a little free library I spotted on my way back from the thrift shop. Though I thought I'd been pretty ruthless when sorting through and weeding out our possessions when packing the boxes in Minnesota, I was amazed by the number of knick-knacks, minor memorabilia, and just plain junk we had transported clear across the country. Why did I think we would need 6 bud vases, 5 boxes of rubber bands, a broken VHS player, a yogurt maker? Well, that one I did understand. Sort of. It had been a birthday present from my mother, one of her constant and not particularly subtle reminders to watch my weight. I had no intention of using it, but since it was brand new and she'd only given it to me a couple weeks before the move, I felt guilty getting rid of it. But 2 years had passed since I'd opened it, which, I was pretty sure, was beyond the gift-guilt statute of limitations, and my mother was almost 2,000 miles away, so I put it in the Goodwill pile. Some choices were close to impossible. A medium-sized box sporting the ubiquitous miscellaneous label contained a melange of papers, folders, flyers, a kitchen towel, picture frames, and a blue plastic water bottle. And that was just the stuff I saw from the top. It was just too much to deal with at that moment, so I closed the lid and shoved it into the front coat closet, promising myself I'd sort through it all later. Another, much larger box labeled with a big question mark, because it had apparently been taped shut before I had a chance to list the contents, was filled with Jamie's winter clothes, things we hadn't thought he'd need until after we closed on the condo. The moment I opened the lid, the air filled with a scent both strange and familiar. A mixture of ripe grain, sandalwood soap, detergent, and strong coffee. Familiar because the instant I breathed it in, I knew it was Jamie's smell. And strange because, until then, I'd never been aware of its existence. But there it was, Jamie's smell. Packed away for all that time, still it clung to every article of his clothing, permeating every thread. I lowered my head, breathing deep. I wanted to dive in head first, burrow into sweatshirts, sweaters, and flannel shirts, immersing myself in the last vestiges of his particular perfume. For a moment, I considered hanging them up in the too cramped closet next to my things. But I stopped myself, imagining what Jamie would have said on the subject, something like, "Don't be so sentimental. There's a lot of good wear in those clothes. I don't need them anymore, but somebody else does." If Z was still living with Sonny, think how happy he'd be to get that warm sweater or that shirt. They're practically new. Jamie always had more than his share of practical Midwestern good sense. I made another drive-through donation, but not before sorting through the box and picking out a few items to include in my quilt. In the morning, I called Monica to tell her I wouldn't be at our support group. "Are you depressed? Should I bring more cannoli?"
"No, it's okay. I'm just busy. I'm painting."
"Painting what?"
"My bedroom wall and some shelves. Maybe a chair. I haven't decided for sure, but I'm kind of on a roll. I don't want to lose my momentum."
"Do you want help? I can come over and give you a hand. I bet Nan would, too. We could have support group at your place this week."
"How about next week? I should have everything finished by then."
"Sounds good. I'll tell Nan. Are you sure you don't need anything?"
"Not right now. I'm okay," I said. And I was. I still missed Jamie. In the days that followed, I experienced moments of sadness and even tears. In time, I came to realize I always would. That was okay. And so was I. Just okay. But it was a start. Monica would have approved. So, I realized, would Jamie.
Chapter 23. Grace.
It's hard for me to explain, but turning the condo into a real home did more to help me handle Jamie's loss than months of therapy could have. Sorting through the trash and treasure of our life together and combining it with new treasures gave me a sense of moving forward while honoring the past. Seeing our old things in this new setting brought so many good memories to the surface, reminding me that, in spite of everything, Jamie and I had had a wonderful, even enviable life together. It also helped me to fulfill one of his final wishes. When Jamie decided to give up the idea of medical school and become a paramedic instead, he said he wanted to use the money we'd been saving for his someday tuition as a down payment. Though I had long dreamed of having a home of our own, I wasn't so sure. It bothered me to think that Jamie might be giving up on his dream just so I could have a house. "I'm not," he'd assured me. "My dream was always working in the medical field and helping people. I'm getting to do that, only a lot faster. I don't want to wait anymore, Grace. The other part of my dream is giving you a home and family and all the things you've wanted. I want you to have an amazing life, but the house is just a down payment on that. I love you more than anything, Grace, and I meant what I said. As soon as I finish school, it's your turn."
"Turn for what?" I'd laughed. "I already have you. What more could I possibly want?"
"More," he'd said. Until I opened that first can of paint, I'd forgotten about that conversation. The trauma of Jamie's accident, followed by the months of constant tension that came from worrying about his care, had crowded so many good memories into the far corners of my mind, including the fact that, on the drive out from Minnesota, he'd talked about wanting to use that exact color on the walls of our new bedroom. Turquoise was Jamie's favorite. He had three shirts in that color, one of which I had cut up to use as cornerstone patches in his quilt. For the next week, I worked from first light until last. Painting was cheap and made a big difference. I painted the living room walls a beautiful pearl gray, and the bedroom and bath the lovely light turquoise Jamie had talked about, and that I had unwittingly chosen when I went to the paint store. It made a nice contrast against the white molding and cabinets. When the furniture arrived, things really started to take shape. To start with, for the first time in 2 years, my mattress was off the floor. And when I made up the bed with a white eyelet bedskirt I'd found for 60% off on the discount table at Target, and the turquoise and coral quilt my mother-in-law gave me for my 30th birthday, it looked pretty and so inviting. Maisie, however, wasn't as thrilled with the changes as I was. After I finished making the bed, she stood next to it and gave me a look that said, "You're joking, right? Where's the escalator?" I went back to the thrift shop, bought a wooden step stool for $3, and spray-painted it white. The minute I set it down, Maisie hopped up on the bed, curled up into a ball on my pillow, and went to sleep. Problem solved. The bathroom didn't need much besides paint. However, I did splurge on a new set of coral-colored towels and completed the look with a little bouquet of silk daisies in a tiny galvanized tin bucket. The whole thing looked fresh and pretty and feminine. Too feminine for Jamie's taste, but I don't think he would have minded. The kitchen didn't need much either. Giving the cabinets a good scrub cheered things up a lot, but I also changed the old wooden knobs for some new polished chrome pulls. The difference was amazing. Next, I removed the mismatched plates and plastic cups from the glass front cabinet and replaced them with the raspberry dinnerware and a set of 6 blue glass goblets that I found, also on sale, which made it even better. There's something incredibly satisfying about grubbing through a discount bin and finding a pretty something you absolutely adore. Besides the goblets, I found a ceramic salad bowl that wasn't precisely the same raspberry as the dishes, but close, which I put on the counter and filled with fruit. I also nabbed a vintage-style mason jar caddy, like you'd use for canning, then filled the jars with some gravel and potting soil and planted them with parsley, rosemary, cilantro, and thyme. I've never had much space or talent for gardening, so I wasn't sure how long the plants would survive, but that little spot of green on my kitchen windowsill looked very pretty and homey. Nan, I thought, would be thrilled. She was always saying, "It takes living things to bring a room alive."
I was starting to see what she meant. My final and largest project was the living room. My downstairs neighbor let me borrow her portable upholstery steamer. By the time I finished cleaning the velvet, removed the weird black balls from the bottom, and screwed on 4 new natural wood-colored wooden legs, the sofa looked brand new. That big splash of blue velvet against those pearl-gray walls was elegant, but so vibrant. 2 apple crates from Minnesota, topped with a rectangle of thick glass, made a cute coffee table, and I jazzed up the floor lamp by hot-gluing some gray, pink, and white chevron fabric over the old shade. They turned out great and cost me $13.67 to make. It had become something of a competition, trying to see how little I could spend while still getting the look I wanted. Spray paint is the best friend of a girl on a budget. I used it to freshen up the ugly floating shelves before bolting them to the living room wall to hold books, knick-knacks, and family photos. I mounted some smaller shelves on either side of the little bow window that overlooked the street. That bow window added so much to the space. It was just big enough to hold the pine desk, which I also painted white. I put my sewing machine on the desk and some mason jars filled with thread, buttons, trim, pins, and other sewing notions on the floating shelves, and voila, instant sewing studio. It was compact, for sure, but efficiently laid out, and I'd always wanted a dedicated sewing room. The final, and if I do say so myself, most ingenious addition to my living space was the idea I had for refurbishing the wicker side chair. Once again, I broke out the spray paint, but this time I used a very pretty green, a color like leaves of birch trees in the early days of spring. Once the paint was dry, I removed the seat, ripped off the old fabric, and recovered it with a yard of sturdy white twill. Then, with yarn from a needlepoint project I started but never finished, I stitched through the evenly placed holes in the wicker chair back to create a pretty pattern of blue flowers with bright pink centers growing on dark green vines. The total cost of the project was only $21, but when I put it next to the sapphire love seat, it pulled the whole room together. In terms of physical exertion, I'm not sure I ever worked as hard as I did during those 5 days when I was decorating the condo, but the results were worth every drop of sweat, and way more than the $530 I put into the decorating. I felt proud of my accomplishment, and knew that Jamie would have been proud of me too. I placed the last picture on the bookshelf, a photo of Jamie and me on our canoeing and camping trip to Bearhead Lake State Park, a honeymoon delayed by a year and a half because of Jamie's cancer, and stood back to admire the completely transformed and absolutely beautiful space. "Thank you, honey," I said, turning in a circle and smiling. "It's just what I've always wanted, a real home." Of course, no decorating project is ever truly finished. Throw pillows and drapery panels could come later, when I found a fabric I loved at a price I was willing to pay, and I would keep my eye out for a nice, inexpensive rug to define the living room area. The biggest ticket item on my wish list was a table. Something that could do dual duty for both dining and crafting. I didn't have room for one of each. It would be nice, too, if there was some kind of storage included, a place to stow crafting tools. But even if I could find one to meet my needs, the table would have to wait. Considering all I'd accomplished, $530 wasn't much. But until I had a steady source of income, I wouldn't spend one more unnecessary dollar. Monica was right. The clock was ticking. 2 weeks had already passed since my unceremonious termination from Spectre. In 2 more days, right after Monday night's big reveal for Nan and Monica, I'd start my job search in earnest. In the meantime, there was one more project I wanted to tackle, something I'd been thinking about ever since the conversation in my head when Jamie told me how happy Z would have been to get his old sweater or hand-me-down shirt. I went to my bedroom closet, which now finally had space enough so my twirly skirts wouldn't get wrinkled, pulled out the box of my old fabric, and started searching through the contents until I found just what I was looking for. Rosy pink background printed with pastel pop-eyed owls. Perfect. "You're joking," Sunny said, as if she really believed I was playing some sort of trick on her. She held the dress up to her shoulders, looking it over carefully.
It looks brand new.
It is.
Oh. Was it too small for you? I bet the store would let you return it.
Well, it is too small for me. I wear a 12, and I'm guessing you're about a 4. But I didn't buy it. I made it. For you.
You made it for me?
She said. Then, as if she was sure she'd gotten it wrong, she said,
For me? Why?
Because I thought you'd look nice in pink. Because I thought you'd like something new. And because, for some reason, I thought you'd like owls.
I love owls,
Sunny exclaimed. She covered her mouth with a hand as her eyes began to fill, only to move it a moment later and say,
Look, even the buttons are little owls.
I grinned, excited that she was so excited.
I know, aren't those fun?
I know it's not very practical. You'll probably want to wait until summer to wear it. Oh, hang on, I almost forgot. I reached into the bottom of the shopping bag I'd brought to hold the outfit. Here's a sweater to layer over the dress when it gets chilly. It's used and probably kind of big for you, but the color is perfect, and I washed it, so...
Sunny lunged toward me and threw her arms around me so forcefully that I not only couldn't finish my sentence, I dropped the bag and the sweater onto the sidewalk.
Thank you, Grace. Thank you so much. She smelled like weed and sweat and dirt. I hugged her anyway.
People walk past me every day, and they look right through me like I don't even exist. Or if they do look at me, and I catch them, they shift their eyes away fast and pretend they weren't. You know? You're not like that. You look and talk to me the same way you'd talk to anybody in the neighborhood. Like I belong here. But with most of them, she said, shaking her head as she finally let go of me, it's like they're embarrassed for me.
Sunny's eyes started to fill again, and she put her fist to her mouth, pressing hard against her lips until she regained her composure.
And I know I'm an embarrassment, I get that. And I know it's probably my own fault. I mean, sure, I've got a sad story to tell. But so does everybody else, right? So why am I here?
She asked, spreading her hands and glancing over at the concrete planters, the cardboard floor, and dirty sleeping bag.
What's wrong with me? Nobody wants to end up like this, she said, then let out a short, bitter laugh. Nobody grows up dreaming about living on the street and being an addict. I'd like to stop, but I can't. It's too hard. But that doesn't mean I'm not a human being, you know? A ghost you can see right through.
I'm a person, she said, pressing her fist to the middle of her chest, directly over her beating heart.
Maybe I'm a failure and a disappointment, and an addict, but I'm still a person. I want what everybody else wants, you know? I just want
to be seen, I said, and nodded my head.
I get it, Sunny. I know.
Chapter 24. Grace. For the first time in my life, I entertained friends in a home of my own. Monica supplied a pan of spinach and ricotta stuffed shells with marinara for the main course, and Nan brought cold grilled asparagus and a salad of baby lettuce, the first fruits of her spring garden. Over Monica's objections, I handled the appetizers and dessert. Maybe I couldn't cook, but anybody can shop. And in Portland, home of artisan everything, finding fresh, delicious gourmet food is as easy as taking a walk in the park. On Saturday, Maisie and I went downtown to the farmer's market in the park blocks. After wandering through the stalls, admiring piles of artfully arranged produce that was so fresh and bright and beautiful it seemed almost too pretty to eat, I bought a box of artisan crackers sprinkled with sesame and poppy seeds, 3 slivers of delicious, locally made cheese, and ingredients for a strawberry rhubarb sangria recipe I'd found online. On the way home, I stopped by Salt and Straw and picked up 2 quarts of ice cream for dessert. Almond brittle with salted chocolate ganache and strawberry honey balsamic with black pepper. The evening was a great success. The meal was delicious and the sangria started things off on a festive note. I was very gratified when both Nan and Monica asked for the recipe. But most gratifying was the way they kept oohing and aahing over what I'd done to the place. It was the first time Nan had ever been to my condo, but Monica made sure she was able to appreciate the full nature of the transformation by providing a vivid description of what the place had been like before. When she described my bedroom as looking like a cheap dorm in a badly run youth hostel, I said, "Oh, come on, it wasn't that bad." Monica laid her hand on my arm and said, "Yes, it was, Grace. It really, really was." The ice cream was almost as big a hit as the decorating. "Salt and straw?" Monica exclaimed. "I love that place." Nan, who was sitting at the counter on my single stool, said, "I usually get the honey lavender, but this strawberry is delicious." She put down her spoon and looked around the room. "And really, Grace, the whole place looks fabulous." "Thanks," I said, sitting down next to Monica on the love seat. "It's still a work in progress. I'd like to find the perfect table, a nice rug, and make some fabric shades for the windows. But I should hold off on doing anything else until I find a job." "Oh, wait," I cried, springing to my feet and quickly putting my ice cream down on the coffee table. "I forgot to show you my other project." I ran into the bedroom closet and pulled out the second dress I'd made. Same pattern, but a different fabric. Pale blue background printed with pen and ink style drawings of the Eiffel Tower and bright red and blue suitcases. Showing it off to my friends, I explained about the owl dress I'd made for Sunny and how her reaction had inspired me to run right home and make another dress that I intended to donate to a nearby homeless shelter. "It's only a dress," I said, when I realized I'd been gushing. "It's not like it's going to change her life or anything. In fact, she hasn't been around since yesterday, so I'm sure she's off on some kind of bender. She does that sometimes. But the look on Sunny's face, I'll never forget it. Is it crazy to hope that getting a new dress might not just help her feel seen, but actually convince her she's worth something?" "It's never crazy to hope," Nan replied. "Whoever gets this dress will love it just as much as Sunny did." I folded the dress over my arm. "I hope so. It's the most satisfying thing I've done in a long time. I hope my new job, whatever it is, leaves me enough spare time to make a few more. I've got yards and yards of fabric stowed in my closet. It'd be nice to put it to good use." Nan, who was only halfway done with her ice cream, put down her spoon. She stared at me for such a long time that it started to feel uncomfortable, like when somebody sees you've got spinach in your teeth and can't look away, but doesn't tell you either. "What?" I said, covering my mouth with my hand. "Those stuffed shells did have a lot of spinach." "The dresses, don't you see?" she asked, turning from me to Monica and back again, her expression suddenly bright. "That should be your job." My heart beat a bit faster when Nan said that, but it didn't take long for me to start thinking of reasons it couldn't work. I mean, I would have had to sell a lot of dresses to actually make a living doing it. Those dresses took me half a day each to sew. And, as Monica pointed out, opening a business from scratch was risky. It required capital and experience. I had neither. "She'd need to hire employees," Monica said. "Open some kind of workshop or factory. She can't mass-produce dresses with one used sewing machine, cutting them out one by one on her kitchen counter. Besides, the reason Grace found this so satisfying is because she was giving the dresses away, not selling them. It could end up being a nice hobby, but..." Monica shook her head. "I just don't see how this could be a business." Neither could I. And yet, I couldn't stop thinking about it. I couldn't sleep, either. Around 3 in the morning, I finally gave up trying and got out of bed. Maisie gave me a bemused look, then scooted herself onto the warm spot I'd left on the mattress. I went into the living room, got out my sewing basket, and stitched a couple of seams in the Lemoyne star block I was working on, made from Jamie's red flannel shirts. Sewing normally relaxes me, but that night I just couldn't settle into it. I kept thinking about the conviction in Nan's voice when she said that dressmaking should be my business, and then Monica's voice, equally insistent, saying there was no way it could work. Since Monica is the only one of us who'd ever run a business, she was probably right.
After a few minutes, I put my stitching aside and opened the coat closet, thinking I'd sort through the miscellaneous box I'd shoved in there earlier. Now was as good a time as any. Like so many of the other boxes,